All right, imagine this. You're deeply invested in a public institution, maybe university. A key leadership job opens up and a committee gets formed to find the absolute best person. Now, do those really critical discussions, you know, weighing the candidates, happen behind closed doors, or are they out there in the open for everyone to see?
It's a really fundamental question, right? It gets to the heart of governmental transparency, and it's exactly what we're diving into today. We're going deep into Wood v. Marston. It's a pivotal 1983 Florida Supreme Court case that, well, it absolutely shaped the landscape of open government here. And for you, our knowledgeable listener, someone who's already pretty well versed in Florida's open government laws, our mission today is simple. We want to unpack how this landmark decision clarified the really expansive reach of Florida's Sunshine Law, specifically concerning those critical search committees at our state universities. We'll try to illuminate the nuanced arguments, maybe some surprising interpretations, and what it all meant, and frankly, still means for transparency, especially in academia.
Indeed. And the core question, the one right before the court, was whether a university committee, this one specifically tasked with screening candidates for a law school dean, was required to hold its meetings publicly under the Sunshine Law. This wasn't just some, you know, academic exercise. It was a classic tension between two really powerful and sometimes competing values. You've got the public's right to know how decisions are made on one side, and on the other, the university's desire for maybe privacy and really frank discussion in sensitive personnel stuff. We'll explore the compelling arguments from both sides as this thing worked its way up.
Okay, let's set the scene a bit for this legal drama. It all kicked off with what seems like a routine event. Joseph Jukelin, retiring as Dean of the University of Florida College of Law. Now, University President Robert Q. Marston, he had the authority to appoint deans. That was clear. But here's the crucial detail. His authority wasn't absolute. There was a specific provision right in the university's own constitution. It mandated that in making this appointment, the president shall give consideration to the opinion of the faculty by consultation with a special committee of at least three faculty members elected by the faculty. So a faculty committee wasn't just nice to have, it was required.
Right. And it wasn't just an internal university rule either. This faculty involvement, it was also mandated by some pretty powerful external forces. You had the American Association of Law Schools, the ALS, and the American Bar Association, the ABA, through their accreditation standards. These weren't just, like, suggestions. They were non-negotiable requirements. For instance, AALS bylaws said the faculty shall exercise substantial control over decanal and faculty appointments. The ABA's interpretation, even more pointed, it required a substantial degree of involvement and even specified that a dean shall not be appointed over the objections of a majority of the law faculty. Mm-hmm. And this accreditation, well, it was absolutely critical. Why? Because eligibility for the Florida bar required graduating from an AALS or ABA accredited school. So faculty input wasn't just a courtesy, it was, you know, foundational. Foundational to the law school's legitimacy and the careers of its graduates.
Wow, that's a significant layer, really underscores how important this committee actually was. So President Marston tells the law school faculty, okay, elect this search and screen committee. It ended up being 10 people, seven mm-hmm. faculty members, a prominent attorney and university benefactor, Chesterfield Smith.
A big name.
Right. And two non-voting student members. Their job was clear. Solicit candidates, screen them, and then submit a list of the most qualified applicants for the faculty to approve. Then finally send that narrowed list up to Marston for his ultimate choice.
And this is exactly where the conflict started to brew. The committee got a directive from the university vice president, Dr. Robert Bryan. He basically advised them to treat any discussions about candidate qualifications as, quote, privileged communication, meaning it should only happen in executive session. What this meant practically was that the core evaluation work, the real nitty-gritty of deciding who's suitable, who's not, was supposed to happen entirely out of the sunshine, behind closed doors, away from public view. And that directive to conduct these crucial talks in private, well, that's what immediately sparked the legal challenge.
And when you say immediately sparked, you really mean it. Petitioners, representing local news media interests, they didn't waste any time at all. They filed a complaint against Marston and the committee chair, Professor Fletcher Baldwin. They were seeking what's called a declaratory judgment and an injunction. So basically, asking the court to rule on what the law actually meant here and then order them to open the meetings. Circuit Judge R.A. Green Jr., he acted fast, granted a temporary injunction in April 1980, forcing the meetings open while the case moved forward. Now, that temporary order was appealed, but it was affirmed, so the meetings stayed open.
Yeah, and then following a full hearing, this was July 1981, Circuit Judge Benjamin Tench made that temporary injunction permanent. He firmly ordered Marson and Baldwin not to close any committee meetings where, quote, official acts, including evaluations of candidates, would happen. And what's really compelling here, I think, is that the university actually complied with this permanent injunction. The whole dean search process actually went forward entirely in the sunshine, public scrutiny all the way. It kind of provided this real-world test case for the court's later thinking. It basically proved transparency was, well, possible even for something this sensitive.
Right, a live experiment almost. And even though they complied, Marson and Baldwin, they weren't ready to just let it go. They appealed the permanent injunction. And the first district court of appeal, they sided with Marston and Baldwin, reversed Judge Tench's decision. Their reasoning was that the committee was protected by these things they called staff exceptions, and also its remoteness from the decision-making process. And they cited cases like Occidental Chemical and Bennett v. Warden. And that reversal is what truly set up the direct high-stakes conflict that the Florida Supreme Court ultimately had to step in and resolve. This wasn't just a minor disagreement, it was fundamental. Okay, so now we're at the Florida Supreme Court. They took the case specifically because that first district ruling created what lawyers call a direct and express conflict with earlier, really foundational decisions from the Supreme Court itself. Cases like Town of Palm Beach v. Gratison, News Press Publishing, Cuffey Carlson, and Cross v. Reno. This wasn't just a different take. It represented a fundamental split in how the Sunshine Law, which, you know, we all follow closely, was supposed to be interpreted across Florida.
Exactly. And what's fascinating, I think, is how the Supreme Court started its analysis. They basically went back to basics, reiterating their core principle about the Sunshine Law. They emphasized, again, that the law was passed specifically to protect the public from closed-door politics. And because of that, it must be broadly construed to affect its remedial and protective purpose. They made it crystal clear. Governmental entities just cannot carry out decision-making functions outside the law. That broad construction, it's the cornerstone, really, of Florida's whole open government philosophy. And it's absolutely key to understanding why they ruled the way they did.
Okay, but the respondents, Marston and Baldwin, they came back with an interesting argument, didn't they? They said, hey, universities aren't specifically listed as boards or commissions right there in the Sunshine Law itself, so maybe it wasn't meant for them. Was that a fair point?
It was a point they raised, definitely. Are universities truly agencies in the way the law intended for this broad application? The court's counterargument, though, was pretty methodical, very insightful, actually. It revealed what they saw as a deeper legislative intent. They didn't just look at the Sunshine Law by itself. They looked at other key laws that also apply broadly to government bodies. Chapter 119, right? Florida's Public Records Law, and Chapter 120, the Administrative Procedure Act. Now, both of those apply broadly to agencies. And while universities aren't explicitly named as agencies in those definitions, the legislature had taken the trouble to put in specific exemptions for certain university activities, things like, you know, student records or discussions about curriculum. So the court's reasoning, which was pretty clever, was if the legislature had to specifically exempt certain university functions from these broad transparency laws, it must mean they were generally covered to begin with. You see, this idea of general coverage with specific, explicit exceptions is really foundational when you're interpreting these kinds of broad laws. And it strongly signaled that, yes, universities were indeed state agencies for these purposes.
And this is where the Supreme Court, well, they kind of dropped a real bombshell of legislative interpretation. This was the aha moment, truly compelling. They pointed out that the legislature had explicitly exempted certain other high-level search committees from the Sunshine Law in separate statutes specifically, the searches for the Chancellor of the Board of Regents and for community college presidents. The court's insight here was powerful. If the legislature needed to create these specific exemptions, it clearly meant that without such an exemption, those committees would have been covered by the Sunshine Law.
Exactly. It's that classic legal idea. The exception proves the rule. It firmly established, in the court's view, that universities are state agencies for Sunshine Law purposes, and unless there's a specific legislative carve-out, their committees are subject to it, precisely. And so, moving past whether a university is an agency, the court then zoomed in on the function of this specific law school dean search committee. They found its role was way more than just, like, fact-gathering. It had what the court called an undisputed decision-making function in screening candidates and, crucially, rejecting applicants. This wasn't just an advisory group handing over names. It was performing a policy-based decision-making function delegated to it by the president through the faculty. The key point was the committee was actively narrowing the field, making real choices, not just collecting resumes.
Right. And the argument that, well, the full faculty and ultimately the president had the final say, that they could review and even reject the committee's work that didn't sway the court, did it. They called that later review a secondhand retrospective reflection, not the firsthand observation the public is entitled to under the law. The court seemed really aware of the potential for what they called rubber stamping in these review processes, you know, where those initial decisions, even if they're preliminary, they gain momentum and become really hard to overturn later. The public's right, they stressed, is to see that initial decision-making happening, not just the final sign-off.
Yeah, and this point was really hammered home by existing precedent, which the Supreme Court consistently brought up. You had Town of Palm Beach v. Grattanson back in 74. That involved the Citizens Advisory Committee for Zoning. Even though the town council could override their decisions, the court found the committee was performing official acts, subject to the Sunshine Law. Then Krause v. Reno in 79. That was a citizens group screening police chief applicants. The court called them a board because they performed the elimination portion of the decision-making process, even if the city manager wasn't technically bound by their picks. And News Press Publishing Company v. Carlson in 82 really cemented this focus squarely on the nature of the act being performed. Was it decision-making, rather than who was on the committee or how close they were to the final decision? These cases consistently pointed towards where the actual sifting and choosing began, not just where the last signature went on the paper.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. Those arguments that the first district relied on this staff exception and remoteness, the Supreme Court took those apart too, right? How did they tackle those specific claims?
Well, the court clarified that those earlier cases, Occidental Chemical and Bennett v. Warden, they did not create some kind of broad, sweeping loophole in the Sunshine Law. Instead, those cases merely drew a line between, say, privileged internal staff advice or pure fact-finding, the kind of background work that supports a decision, and actual delegated decision-making authority. The crucial distinction, the court stressed, was this. If staff members are appointed to a committee that has been delegated actual authority, they effectively lose their staff identity while serving on that committee. Their role shifts, you see, from internal advisor to public decision maker, and therefore they fall squarely under the Sunshine Law for the purposes of that committee's work.
Ah, I see. And the remoteness argument, how do they dismiss that?
With remarkable clarity, really. The Supreme Court stated pretty emphatically that if an act is in and of itself decision making, it simply cannot be considered remote from the ultimate decision. It doesn't matter how many steps or layers of review are involved in the overall process. The critical question for the court was, is an actual decision, however preliminary or subject to later review, being made by this committee? If the answer is yes, then it's not remote. It's part of the decision-making process the public gets to watch. If you're making a choice, even the first one, the public has a right to see it. Now, this obviously raises a really important question. It's one the respondents, Marston and Baldwin, argued pretty vigorously, and honestly, it's a concern that still comes up today. They claimed opening these committee meetings would seriously threaten academic freedom, you know, hinder the free exchange of ideas, create a chilling effect on candid discussions, and potentially even deter highly qualified people from even applying for these kinds of jobs, because who wants their professional qualifications picked apart in public? It's a legitimate concern you hear in lots of government contexts.
Yeah, that's a classic tension. How did the Supreme Court respond to that? It sounds like a valid point about attracting good candidates.
They gave a very nuanced answer, actually. While they absolutely acknowledged the need for a free exchange of ideas and the vital importance of academic freedom in a university, they stated very firmly that this freedom is not to be used as a shield to mask abuses of the rights of others. Anyway, in other words, you can't use a noble principle like academic freedom to just bypass a fundamental public right like transparency. They also carefully clarified that the public's right under the Sunshine Law is to be spectators. They get to watch but not participate or interfere with the committee's process. They definitely acknowledged the tension, but ultimately they held that the public's right to know carried more weight in this specific balancing act.
And what's particularly compelling in the court's reasoning, I think, is how they pointed back to that real-world test that had already happened. Remember, the search went ahead in the open. They specifically noted that the dean search did proceed entirely in the sunshine after Judge Stench's permanent injunction. And crucially, they observed that the faculty and the committee were more than equal to the challenges of the situation. End quote. So this practical outcome, the fact that the process could and did function effectively with transparency, served as powerful, almost empirical support for their stance. It suggested the perceived burdens weren't insurmountable and didn't justify secrecy. It was almost like the court was saying, look, you can do this openly and the sky won't fall.
Right. So The overarching principle the court really drove home was that Florida's commitment to open government at all levels was, in their words, a compelling consideration. And it decisively outweighed the perceived burdens of transparency in this specific university search context. It really put a fine point on just how seriously Florida takes open government, even when it bumps up against, you know, traditional institutional practices or those legitimate concerns about privacy and candidate pools. Okay, so what does this all mean for how Florida's Sunshine Law gets applied more broadly? The majority decision was undeniably strong, a real statement piece, but it wasn't unanimous, was it? There were other important views expressed by the justices.
Absolutely not unanimous. And Justice Overton's special concurrence is particularly worth looking at. He really emphasized how groundbreaking this decision was. He noted it was the first time the board or commission part of the Sunshine Law was applied to a committee established not by some formal governing body, but by a single governmental executive, like a university president. He wanted to make sure the nuance was crystal clear. Look, purely fact-finding work by staff or strictly advisory chats, that's still okay to do privately. But the minute an executive delegates actual decision-making authority to a committee, boom, that committee falls under the Sunshine Law. He even gave a practical example. A university president could totally look at applications privately, talk to individual staff members one-on-one, but the moment you create a multi-member committee and give it a job involving substantive choices, screening, eliminating, that process has to be public. It really helped define the precise line the majority was drawing.
Okay, so Overton was clarifying the majority's line. But then you had Justice McDonald's sharp dissent. He fundamentally disagreed, right? He argued the legislature just never meant for the Sunshine Law to stretch this far, especially into university search committees.
That's right. McDonald's dissent offered a strong counter-narrative, really focusing on legislative intent and practical consequences. He made several key points. First, he argued that universities, yeah, they're state entities, but they weren't really state agencies in the specific way the Sunshine Law contemplated. Not like, say, the Board of Regents or the Community College Coordinating Board, which are explicitly defined as such. Second, and this is a big one, he brought up the constitutional right to privacy. He argued that forcing public discussion of applicants' merits would make them discard their rights of privacy. He worried about that chilling effect on good candidates and on the free and open discussion needed for these sensitive personnel calls. That privacy concern is powerful and keeps coming up. Third, McDonald pointed right back to those specific legislative exemptions we talked about, the ones for the chancellor and community college president searches. He argued pretty forcefully that those exemptions showed a clear legislative philosophy that search committees are not subject to the Sunshine Law generally. He basically asked, why would a dean search be treated differently by the court when the legislature seemed to think these kinds of searches needed privacy? And finally, he just flat out maintained, the committee in this case performed no official acts. He saw them as simply an advisor to the faculty, who then advised the president. For McDonald, the only official act was the president's final appointment, not the whole recommendation process leading up to it. He viewed the committee as just the functional equivalent of staff. For him, the majority was stretching the law way too far, beyond its original intent, into areas where privacy and practicalities maybe should have won out. So if we synthesize the core takeaways from Wood v. Marston, it just dramatically clarified how incredibly broad the reach of Florida's Sunshine Law really is. It firmly established that even committees that get their authority delegated from a single executive, like a university president, are subject to public scrutiny if they're performing decision-making or policy-based functions, like screening and eliminating candidates. And that holds true no matter how many layers of review are above them, or even if the committee members are technically internal staff. It really reinforced that broad construction of the law, prioritizing public access to government decision-making at every stage where real choices are being made. It pushed Florida even further towards being, you know, a real beacon for open government.
Yeah, it really did. And this case, even looking back now, it highlights the ongoing tension in open government, a tension we still wrestle with today, don't we? How do you balance the public's, well, undeniable right to transparency with those very real practical concerns like attracting top talent to public service, protecting individual privacy in sensitive professional situations, and fostering the kind of frank internal discussions that you sometimes need for robust decision making? It leaves us kind of pondering where that line truly lies, especially as government functions keep evolving and getting more diverse. It's a question that, you know, decades after Wood v. Marston is still being debated in all sorts of different contexts, constantly pushing the boundaries of what it really means to operate in the sunshine.